Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 4 of our discussion about Acts chapter 15. Our goal with this program is to present for you biblically based material that is logical, reasonable, and mature. We hope this program will present the Bible in a way that's rational, grounded in Scripture, and easily applicable to your daily life. In this series, we're discussing the topic of Acts chapter 15. What really happened? In the last two episodes, we've spent considerable time exploring the topic of circumcision, which is such a great, fun, and entertaining subject, isn't it? But seriously, we needed to gain a firm grasp on the role and function of circumcision in order to understand the issue that creates the conflict that we see in Acts chapter 15. As we discussed in our episode 1, the men who journeyed from Judea to Antioch in Acts chapter 15, verse 1, had some preconceived ideas about what circumcision meant. These ideas weren't in line with Scripture, but only with their cultural tradition. What do I mean? Well, let's take a look again at verse 1, the verse that led us on two episodes worth of discussion about circumcision. It says there in verse 1, "But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, 'Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moshe, you cannot be saved.'" Over the course of the last two episodes, when we delved into the details concerning circumcision, which verses did we find that indicated that circumcision was a necessary requirement for salvation? I'll wait. Oh, there are no verses anywhere in the Bible that says that one must be circumcised in order to be saved? So then, where did this mentality come from? Why would these men have insisted that these Gentiles who were new to the faith needed to become circumcised in order to be saved? We touched on this briefly in episode 1, but we'll get into much greater detail here in this episode. The reason these men had this mentality was because of the belief that in order to be saved, one needed first to become Jewish. After all, it was the Jewish people who were the chosen people. To be Jewish, in their minds, meant that you would be saved from judgment, while all the nations, the Gentiles, were doomed to destruction. Circumcision was a sign of the covenant, and those who were in covenant were to be saved, while those who were outside of that covenant were to be destroyed. Now, there is an aspect of truth to that conclusion. Those who are in covenant will be spared from the impending judgment that awaits the world, and those who are not in covenant will not be spared. Additionally, circumcision is the outward physical sign of that covenant. But correlation is not causation. What I mean by that is there's no magical process that takes place when someone gets circumcised that suddenly changes their status. In a previous episode, I pointed out that Muslims also circumcise their males. Does that mean that all Muslims are saved? Of course not. Salvation, as it says in Paul's letter to the Ephesians in chapter 2, verse 8, comes by grace through faith. Salvation is not the result of works. Thus, circumcision will not affect one's status of salvation one bit. This explains why the very next verse in Acts chapter 15, verse 2, says that Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with these men who were telling the Gentiles who were coming to faith that they needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. Verse 2 also tells us that they were apparently unable to resolve this debate in Antioch. So it was agreed that Paul and Barnabas and some others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and to the elders about this question. Now, before we get into what happened next, there's a logical question here that must be asked. How had these men conflated circumcision with salvation? It has long been the position within Jewish theology that in order to be saved, one needed to become Jewish. But what does that look like? By what process would one become Jewish? To answer that question, we need to look no further than Chabad.org. The process has remained basically unchanged for over 2,000 years. According to Jewish tradition, In order to become Jewish, you must do four things. This list of four things that are necessary in order to convert to Judaism has pretty much remained the same from that time to this time. The same list that existed in the first century still exists today. On the Chabad.org website, it says this under How to Convert to Judaism. Conversion to Judaism has a few components, which are undertaken under the supervision of an established Beit Din. Now, I'll pause there to explain what a Beit Din is in case you're not familiar with that term. A Beit Din is a phrase that refers to a house of judgment, and by Jewish rule, a Beit Din consists of three men that sit as judges, and that at least one of them has to be the ranking official. He has to be schooled in the ways of Torah. So basically, over any community or group of people, there has to be a group that recognizes that these three men are essentially in charge. Okay, so a conversion to Judaism has to be established under the auspices of this group of three men who approve of this process taking place. That's what a Beit Din is. All right, so back to these four things that are required. The first requirement, according to Chabad.org, accepting the yoke of the commandments. When you convert, you must verbalize your commitment to live in accordance with all of the Torah's commandments as they are explained in the Torah law. It is not enough to commit to some or even most of the precepts. A convert must commit to every single one of them. Also, this needs to be done out of a sincere desire to serve God as a Jew, not because of any other motive, such as the desire to marry a Jewish man or woman. The second point they make, immersion in the mikveh. A mikveh is a pool of natural water, usually rainwater. At your conversion, you will dunk into this spiritually cleansing bath. It is at this moment that you will accept the Torah upon yourself. So, this goes to show that the Baptists were not the first people to dunk people in a baptism. The third requirement, according to Chabad.org, circumcision. If you are a male, you will need to be circumcised. If you were circumcised as a baby, a symbolic drawing of blood is all that will be done at this point. What? Yes, if you were a grown man, for instance, if I were to attempt to convert to Judaism, although I have already been circumcised when I was a baby, yet that would not be significant enough according to this. So in the typical Jewish synagogue, what would happen in that scenario if I wanted to convert to Judaism is they would suggest, convince that me that I needed to have this ceremony in which a pinprick would be done that would draw blood as a symbolic re-circumcision. None of that makes any sense, but it's somehow causing you to identify with the circumcision. Take that for what it is. The fourth point they have listed here on Chabad.org. When the temple stood in Jerusalem, a convert would bring a special sacrifice to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. When the temple is rebuilt, may it be speedily in our days, converts will again bring sacrifices. And indeed, we will see at some point, according to the things that we've covered in some previous episodes on, has the Levitical system been done away with? We talked about those prophecies that take place in the prophets about how the sacrificial system in the kingdom seemed to be reestablished. And at that time, indeed, it says all nations will come up and they will bring their sacrifices. If you want more information on that, tune in to Has the Levitical System Been Done Away With?, which is a previous series that we have done. Now, back to this point from Chabad.org and the conversion process to Judaism. This same process that is listed on the Chabad website was in practice in the first century, and the Jewish mindset was essentially the same. If you wanted to become saved, it required a conversion to Judaism. If you wanted to convert to Judaism, it required, at a minimum, a mikveh, a baptism, and a circumcision. This was the mindset that these men in Acts chapter 15, verse 1, were operating under. So, for these men, whom I'm sure meant well, it was simply part of the process to expect these Gentiles to become circumcised. The problem is that they associated circumcision with salvation. As we can see from verse 2, Paul vehemently opposes this view. This argument becomes a key theme for Paul in many of his letters to the dispersed churches. Paul addresses this same topic in Romans chapter 2, Romans chapter 4, Galatians chapter 2, chapter 4, and chapter 5, and Colossians chapter 2, as well as several other places. We're going to take a look at all these passages during this series. Paul's letters repeatedly reveal Paul's attempts to combat this mentality, this concept that you needed to convert to Judaism in order to be saved. In his letter to the Romans, Paul addresses this subject in chapter 2. Beginning in verse 11, he says, "For Elohim shows no partiality. For all who have sinned without the Torah will also perish without the Torah, and all who have sinned under the Torah will be judged by the Torah. For it is not the hearers of the Torah who are righteous before Elohim, but the doers of the Torah who will be justified. For when Gentiles, who do not have the Torah, by nature do what the Torah requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the Torah. They show that the work of the Torah is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. And their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, Elohim judges the secrets of men by Yeshua HaMashiach." Okay, so let's pause here and comment on what Paul has said so far. Here in chapter 2, right near the beginning of his letter to the church in Rome, Paul establishes the point that every human being stands before Adonai in exactly the same position. We all sin. The question is, were we aware of the commands of Torah before we sinned? Or were we ignorant of those commands? For all who have sinned without having knowledge of the Torah will face judgment based upon what Adonai has revealed to them through nature and through his voice speaking to them as well, but not by being measured up against the commands of Torah. What I mean here is that what Paul is saying is that if someone is living in sin and they are completely unaware of the Torah, it's not going to be by the Torah that Adonai will judge them. Rather, as Paul illustrated in the previous chapter in Romans chapter 1, Paul states that all of creation speaks about and gives testimony of the greatness of Adonai. Thus, as Paul points out, those who have not heard the commands of the Torah are still without excuse, as they will be held accountable to the other multiple ways that Adonai has revealed himself to them. We will all be held accountable. The question is, which measure will be used in that judgment? Paul says in chapter 2, verse 12, that all those who do know the commands of the Torah and still sin will be held accountable by the commands found within the Torah. That will be our measure. Paul then clarifies in verse 13 that simply knowing the commands found within the Torah is not enough. It's the doing of those instructions that will lead to justification. Then Paul goes on to point out that those to whom the message of the Torah has not been revealed still display behavior that's in line with the Torah. This reveals that they have recognized the many other ways that Adonai has revealed himself to them through the creation, and they have agreed to submit themselves to him to the best of their understanding and ability. This, Paul asserts, is the evidence that the Torah has been written upon their hearts. Wait, the Torah has been written upon the hearts of those who have never even heard the Torah? How can this possibly be? Is it possible that those who have never even heard the message of the Torah could be participants in the new covenant that's described in Jeremiah chapter 31, where Adonai speaks about how he will write the Torah upon the hearts of those who are devoted to him? Yeah. This is how, by the way, we answer the questions about what if someone lives on a remote island and they never hear the gospel message once in their life? Are they destined to hell? Ultimately, the one who will judge them is aware of how many breadcrumbs he's placed in front of them in order to lead them to him. He also knows that those who respond to those clues that he gives them will be rewarded according to their willingness to recognize him as sovereign and to submit themselves to his lordship. Ultimately, we're all held accountable based upon our level of acknowledgement of his authority over our lives, whether we hear the Torah or the gospel message or not. For those of us who have heard those messages, we're held to a higher standard than those who have not. That is why the New Testament authors like Paul and James focus so much on our behavior. Our actions should be a reflection of our knowledge of the will of Adonai. The way that we live our lives should be in line with what's been revealed to us. This principle is true regardless of how little or how much we have heard. Now, lest you think that I'm preaching some kind of universalist message, please don't misunderstand me. I am not saying that everyone will be allowed into his kingdom or that there's another way to salvation aside from through Yeshua. I affirm that there is only one way to come to the Father through his Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. What I am saying is that Adonai uses just weights and measures. And if someone has never heard that message that Yeshua is the way, the truth, and the life, Adonai is not going to hold them accountable to that same measure that he holds us accountable to. But make no mistake, he has presented them with the reality of his sovereignty. Because he is a just judge, and because he knows the thoughts and intentions of each heart, he knows exactly how to make that determination, much better than any of us ever will. Good thing he's the judge and we aren't. Paul here is expressing that same line of thought in Romans chapter 2. As he continues through his thoughts in this chapter, he challenges his Jewish brethren about their position as Jews. Picking back up in verse 25, he says, "For circumcision is of value if you obey the Torah, but if you break the Torah, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision." Huh? If we're circumcised and we sin, the foreskin in our flesh is going to be restored? Of course not. That's not what he's saying here. Paul is speaking about what circumcision is supposed to represent. It's a sign of your dedication to the covenant of serving Adonai. What Paul is saying here is that if you pledge yourself to serve Adonai and you take upon yourself the mark in your flesh as a sign of that pledge, but you then fail to live up to that pledge, then your pledge was meaningless in the first place. In this specific context, Paul is saying to his Jewish brothers, who see the sign of circumcision as a sign of salvation, that if they're circumcised, saved, but they live their lives as if there is no Torah that they have to obey, then their circumcision, their salvation, is nullified, and they become like the uncircumcised nations among them. This is because physical circumcision means nothing if it's not a symbol of what's taken place within the heart of a person, the circumcision of the heart. Now, we'll get more into the details of that shortly, but back to verse 26, Paul goes on to say, "So if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the Torah, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? Then he who is physically uncircumcised but keeps the Torah will condemn you who have the written code and circumcision but break the law. For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter." In these verses, Paul is demonstrating that the Gentile who comes to faith in Messiah and who lives their life in obedience to the Torah will be more righteous, despite their physical uncircumcision, than the one who is born Jewish, who is circumcised on the eighth day of life, but who fails to uphold the Torah. The status of being physically circumcised is of little consequence if it's not a reflection of a change of heart that's taken place within a person. This is Paul's entire point. Physical circumcision is not only not required for salvation, as the men in Acts chapter 15:1 stated, but it's worthless if it's not accompanied by a heart that's completely devoted to Adonai and behavior that reflects that devotion. In Romans chapter 4, Paul continues this theme by bringing up Abraham, the one to whom the command to circumcise as a sign of the covenant was first delivered. In verse 9, which we've read from several times already in this series, Paul says, "Is this blessing then only for the circumcised, or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all those who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but who also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. The point Paul makes here is incredibly important to understand. Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness long before he ever became circumcised. Those who walk according to that same faith that Abraham demonstrated before his circumcision will also have their faith credited as righteousness, regardless of whether or not they are circumcised in the flesh. It's not physical circumcision that is of importance. Now, allow me to rephrase. Physical circumcision is important, but it's not in any way a requirement for salvation. Lest anyone misunderstand me, allow me to repeat myself in a different way. I am not saying that physical circumcision is unimportant. It's a sign of the covenant. But it's only a symbol of the circumcision that is to take place inwardly, a circumcision made without knives, without hands. This is the circumcision of the heart. Paul describes it in this way in his letter to the church at Colossae. In him also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of flesh, by the circumcision of Mashiach, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of Elohim, who raised him from the dead. And you, who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, Elohim made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. These he set aside, nailing it to the cross. When we heard the gospel message, when we were faced with the consequences of our own sin and depravity, and were made aware through the account of his death, burial, and resurrection that Yeshua took our rightful punishment upon himself on our behalf, when we then committed our life by confessing with our mouths that he is Lord and believing in our hearts that Adonai raised him from the dead, at that moment we had a circumcision experience. All of us who have that testimony, whether male or female, had a circumcision experience at that moment. This circumcision was upon our hearts. When we made repentance, when we turned from our wayward ways and turned toward following his ways and began to walk in his precepts and instructions, he circumcised our hearts the way that he describes through Moshe in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 16, and in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 6, as we looked at in our last episode. When we confess him as Lord, he removes our hearts of stone, the heart that's hard and opposed to his ways. And he replaces it with a heart of flesh, one that's soft and pliable, just as he describes through his prophet Ezekiel in chapter 11, verse 19, and chapter 36, verse 26. The men who came from Judea to Antioch in Acts chapter 15, verse 1, displayed by their expressed opinions that they had not grasped this message. They clearly demonstrated that they had failed to understand that the circumcision of the heart is what Adonai desires from us, not circumcision of the flesh. At least, not in the context of salvation anyway. Circumcision of the flesh serves its purpose, as we will look at in our next episode, but that purpose has nothing to do with our eternal status or with our position within the kingdom of Adonai. Yet that was exactly the position these men from Judea were holding to. This mentality had permeated much of Jewish thought by the time of the first century, and it was a constant battle that Paul faced in his attempts to overcome this mindset. We can see that from Paul's letter to the church in Galatia. The letter to the Galatians is one of those highly misunderstood letters of Paul. Historically, much of Christendom has misinterpreted this letter in particular, simply due to the fact that they are unfamiliar with the context of the nature of the conflict that Paul was addressing in this letter. Paul was combating the mentality that only Jews are saved, that all Gentiles are doomed for destruction, and in order to become saved, all Gentiles needed to convert to Judaism. As we dig further into Acts chapter 15, it would become more readily apparent that the leaders of the first century church agreed with Paul and did not share this mentality that their Jewish brethren held to. So when we see Paul's words in Galatians chapter 4 and chapter 5, which appear to pit the law and freedom in Messiah against one another, which we'll look at momentarily, we need to first back up to Genesis chapter 2 and 3 in order to understand what Paul is saying there, because that lays the groundwork for chapters 4 and 5. In chapter 2, verse 16, Paul says, "We know that a person is not justified by works of the Torah, but through faith in Yeshua HaMashiach. So we also have believed in Yeshua HaMashiach in order to be justified by faith in Messiah and not by works of the Torah, because by works of the Torah, no one will be justified." In making that statement, Paul was addressing this mentality that we've been discussing, that Gentiles need to convert in order to be considered saved. This is evidenced by the previous verse, verse 15, where he identifies his audience. "We ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners." Paul is not speaking here to Gentile believers. He's telling the Jewish believers in Galatia that their salvation doesn't come by birth, but by faith in Messiah. He's addressing the mentality that one can become justified and righteous through the conversion process. This is why he says in verse 21, "I do not nullify the grace of Elohim, for if righteousness were through the Torah, then Messiah died for no purpose." In other words, Paul is saying here that righteousness cannot be obtained by following a list of rules, but that it comes through faith in Messiah. For a more in-depth conversation about the topic of obtaining righteousness, please refer to our previous series on the topic of what is the gospel. Paul continues this theme in the third chapter of Galatians. He reminds them in verse 6 of the principle that Abraham was justified by faith prior to the receiving of the Torah. He follows up in verse 7 by stating, "Know then that it is those of faith who are sons of Abraham." He then quotes from Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, and says this in verse 11, "Now it is evident that no one is justified before Elohim by the Torah, for the righteous shall live by faith." The running theme here that Paul is expressing is that righteousness was never attainable by merely following the Torah. Neither could righteousness be obtained by being born Jewish, nor could it be obtained by converting to Judaism. Righteousness has always been assigned to those who, like Abraham, demonstrated faith. This, then, leads us to some of the most misunderstood verses from Paul's letter to the Galatians. Verses 24 and 25 say this in the ESV version, "So then, the Torah was our guardian until Messiah came, in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we're no longer under a guardian." This is typically interpreted with a replacement theology type mindset. Often these verses are used to support the concept that we no longer need to follow the Torah. See, right there it says that we're no longer under a guardian. That guardian is identified as the Torah. Thus, we no longer need to follow the Torah because it was only to lead us to Messiah. Now, there are numerous holes in that interpretation, most of which we don't have the time to discuss currently, but let's point out just a few before moving on. First, the word that's used here in the ESV, translated as guardian, is translated as tutor in some versions and as schoolmaster in yet other versions. The Greek word that's used here in these verses is pedagogos. Now, we know this word in English as pedagogue, which means strict teacher. In Greek society, this word refers to a tutor who trains young boys. Generally, this tutor was a trustworthy slave who served the master of the house, and in particular, trained that master's sons. This slave was expected to supervise the activities of these boys and train them in life and in morality. These boys were strictly prohibited from going anywhere without the supervision of this tutor. That's why our modern word pedagogue implies a strict teacher This word is a contraction of two separate words, and if you were to take these two words and combine them and translate it literally, it would mean to lead children. The word tutor is actually a very good rendering of this word. Keeping this in mind, if we think about a tutor, it refers to someone who trains and instructs pupils. In regard to the Torah, functioning as a pedagogos, this would mean that the function and purpose of the Torah would be to train and instruct us. Makes sense, right? In regard to Paul's comment that the Torah was our pedagogos until Messiah came, and follow that up with, now that faith has come, we are no longer under a pedagogos, this is to be understood as a statement that is pro-Torah, not against Torah. What do I mean by that? Well, when you study under a tutor and learn from them, when you receive training and instruction from someone who functions in your life as basically a mentor to you, do you disregard everything that they taught you when you no longer need their tutelage? Of course not. Let me ask it another way. When you graduated from grade school and attended middle school or junior high, whichever you called it, did you abandon everything that you were taught in grade school now that you were at a different school or a different grade level? No. Likewise, when you graduated from middle school to high school, did you abandon what you learned in middle school? How about when you went to college? Did you depart from what you learned in high school when you went to college? Of course not. That would be nonsense. You don't completely start over from the beginning every time you move up to a higher level. Instead, you build upon what you've already learned. What you learned at the lower level is the very foundation for understanding the instruction you will receive at the higher level. In the same way, when young boys would become of age and would leave their pedagogos, they didn't start all over again and completely disregard everything that their tutor had taught them. Instead, that instruction was the basis upon which everything else that they learned was understood. Thus, when Paul calls the Torah a pedagogos, he's saying that it's the foundation upon which our faith is built. When Paul says that the Torah was our tutor, our guardian, until Messiah comes, does this mean that we abandon the Torah now that he has come? No way! Instead, without our awareness of the Torah, we would have no acknowledgement of our need for a Messiah in the first place. The entire point of the Torah is to illustrate our need for a Savior and to demonstrate to us our desperate need to be delivered by that Savior. The fullness of the Torah points to Messiah. When we come to faith in that Messiah, do we toss out what we've learned from the Torah? Absolutely not. As an example, when we come to faith in Messiah, should we abandon the Ten Commandments? How about the other instructions like, I don't know, loving your neighbor? No, Messiah even doubled down on those instructions from the Torah, claiming that if we even hate someone in our heart, we've already committed murder. Or if we desire someone in our heart, we've already committed adultery. And that loving our neighbor was the second greatest commandment. The Torah being called a pedagogos is not a statement that is intended to convey the message that we can toss it out once we've come to faith in Messiah. Rather, Paul was making the point that everything that you have studied in the Torah was intended to lead you to Messiah. Torah was the primary education level lesson plan we needed in order to attend Messiah University, so to speak. The Torah points to Messiah. The Torah teaches us about Messiah and leads us to our desire to seek him out. Those principles don't disappear when we find Messiah. Rather, they confirm and support our belief in him. This applies to everyone, regardless of status, race, or lineage. This is why directly after making these statements, Paul then puts it within the context of the Gentiles coming to faith. Verses 28 and 29 say, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Messiah Yeshua. And if you are Messiah's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise." Now, by saying that there is neither Jew nor Greek, is Paul saying that when you come to faith in Messiah, that your race and nationality just disappears magically? No, he's saying something else completely different. In saying that there is neither slave nor free, is he saying that all slaves are now set free? Well, not unless we also assume that he's saying that everyone who's already currently free needs to give up that freedom. When Paul said that there is no male or female, is he saying that we now live in a genderless society? Of course not. This entire statement is about status in the kingdom. Bringing it back to the theme we've been discussing here, Paul's establishing that when a Gentile comes to faith in Messiah, there's no need for them to convert to Judaism. They come to faith the way Abraham did, even while uncircumcised. Because we all come to him by faith, and not because of who our parents were or were not, we all stand on equal footing within the kingdom. Neither Jew nor Greek has an advantage, as we all approach by faith. Neither slave nor free has an advantage, as we are all set free by his grace, and we are all also willingly placing ourselves into being his bondservant upon our confession of faith in him. Neither male nor female has any advantage, for it is by faith that both men and women approach him. It's by faith that both men and women receive a circumcised heart. We are all Abraham's children. Father Abraham had many sons, and many sons had Father Abraham, and I am one of them, and so are you. So let's just praise the Lord. And on that note, we come to an end of this fourth episode on the topic of Acts chapter 15. Please join us for our next episode, where we will continue to look at Paul's letter to the Galatians, as well as several other passages that will help us to understand the source of the conflict that took place in Acts chapter 15. Until then, shalom.
Hi, I'm Kimberly with Lion and Lamb Ministries, and I am so excited to tell you about our new program on lionandlamb.tv. It's called Come to the Table. You know, some of life's best conversations happened around a table. Whether it's the kitchen table, your dining room table, or even just having a cup of coffee on your couch. On Come to the Table, we'll talk openly about real life issues on our messianic walk. Faith, family, and everything in between. And I'll introduce you to some friends of mine who are walking out their calling in powerful ways. So pull up a chair and join me every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on lionandlamb.tv. Come to the table and let's do life together.